argument of the morning. It's case number 5. Case numbers 22-1086 and 22-2280. Yeah. Help me on the last name of your client.
If I only have to say it once, Wojciechowicz.
Wojciechowicz versus the Attorney General Merrick Garland. Ms. Anderson-Stepanek, nice to see you. You may proceed.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, as stated, my name is Lauren Anderson-Stepanek, and I am representing Mr. Eugeniusz Wojciechowicz. This is a case that has been in front of this court before on a discretionary matter, and today I'm presenting it on a non-discretionary matter. My client is a lawful was a lawful permanent resident of 23 years. He's married to a United States citizen, has 2 children, and he was arrested one time in 2011 for a financial crime that resulted in 2 years of probation and restitution. Between the years of 2011 and 2019, my client repaid the restitution. He successfully completed his probation. And in 2019, he departed the United States. He went to the funeral of his sister, who had died by suicide. When he returned, he was found inadmissible to the United States. And what I will point out is before he left, he was not deportable. The United States government did not make any move to deport him because under our sometimes bizarre Immigration and Nationality Act, as the justices are aware, you aren't always deportable, but you might be inadmissible. And when he presented himself at the border, he was in fact found to be inadmissible based upon his conviction, which constituted that wondrous term of a crime involving moral turpitude. So he presented his case to the immigration judge. He filed a 212H waiver, which is a waiver based upon that he qualified for inadmissibility. He had to demonstrate that his family, specifically his spouse, would experience extreme and unusual hardship. And it was denied. He appealed that to the Board of Immigration Appeals, and he then, his case was denied by the board, saying that the judge had used, you know, their discretion appropriately for that. And then it was appealed to this court, and this court also dismissed the appeal because it was a discretionary issue. The court found that they really couldn't review what had happened because of the fact that, again, going back to our Immigration and Nationality Act, this court doesn't have the authority to look at discretionary issues. My client was in detention throughout all of this. A year and a half is the time period that he was in detention for trying to resolve this issue. During that period, he filed a pardon. He had had, you know, the appropriate amount of time that he had showed that he had changed character, that he had fulfilled all the requirements under his sentence, and he applied for a pardon, an executive pardon, okay? And that's an important term of art for purposes that I'll mention later.
The background that you've provided, I think, completely accurate. It aligns with what we've seen in the briefs. He still runs back into the statutes, though, does he not?
Well,
because Section 1227 dealing with removability, right, would...
That would be deportability, but 1182 is inadmissibility.
Correct, but 1182 now does not have the waiver authority in it that 1227 has. So that's his challenge, is it not?
And you would be right. If we were relying on that, you would absolutely be right. What we are... And I'm going to assume that Your Honor is fine with me moving on beyond the facts.
Yeah, definitely.
Of the case. Okay. So what we would point out is once he received the executive pardon, he became unusual, if you will, in regards to other cases that are similar and that have been cited here, is that he is now, and he's still physically, if not legally, in the United States. Because again, bizarre immigration law, we have a distinction. My client, at the time that he presented himself for reentry in 2019, was never, even though he was physically here, he was never legally here, right? He was outside the United States. So when he received that pardon, because he is not legally admitted into the United States, he still falls within the admissibility issue. He is still knocking on the door to seek entry into the United States. Now, if we look at then, for instance, 22 CFR 40.21A5, or the Foreign Affairs Manual, 302.32B3H, a visa applicant is not ineligible for a visa under IMA 212A2AII or 212A2B.
Yeah, how do you reconcile that, though, with the statute?
With,
so with 11, the provision in 1182 that does not contain the waiver of authority, the waiver of authority that is present in 1227.
I think we can distinguish it. Because
the regulation and any executive branch guidance implementing the regulation, it has to be consistent with the statute, does it not?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I wouldn't argue otherwise, but and it could be that I'm misunderstanding the question here, and because we don't have to rely on the pardon waiver because it applies to deportable aliens.
No, right. He's inadmissible. I get that. Okay. So you don't, I know that. You don't have to rely upon 1227. Okay.
Okay. And so,
but what I understand you to be arguing is that the pardon is nonetheless of significance to him for the readmission to the United States.
Exactly. It is very significant.
Okay. Now put that, now make that same argument in statutory terms.
Well, I would be referencing the you're asking me instead of the regulation. For the statutory terms, we, and this could be the issue here, Your Honor, is that my client is now seeking entry,
right,
based upon his relationship and having a U.S. citizen and the ability to adjust through an I-130 visa petition filed by his wife. And then we, and the issue is that once he has that pardon, that opportunity is available to him. And that is a change of facts that had not previously been available. And then we timely file that motion because of the exception and the sua sponte ability to file a motion to reopen and reconsider. We timely file that motion to reopen in order for him to seek that remedy of adjustment that he no longer requires a waiver. There is no waiver necessary to my client if he is inadmissible and not deportable. As an example, when he goes now, because he's in Poland, when he goes to the consulate now, pursuant to the Foreign Affairs Manual, he will not be found inadmissible because of this pardon. He is no longer inadmissible for that issue. Under the Foreign Affairs Manual, it says that is not ineligible for a visa under INA 212A2AII or 212A2B if she or he has a full and unconditional pardon granted by the President of the U.S., a state governor, or other person specified in 22 CFR 40.21A5. This is an executive pardon. My client has an executive pardon. The irony is, though, that when this was occurring, he was unlawfully removed during a period of having a stay of deportation, And what happened is when the government unlawfully removed him, they created the need to have another waiver. Now he does have a waiver bar issue, a bar issue, because he's been removed from the United States and he requires a waiver to come back in after removal. The government created this situation.
So he would not need the waiver absent the government improperly transporting him to Poland.
That's it, exactly. Otherwise, he would be okay. And I see my time is up.
Well, the reason you're saying that, I think, in response to Judge Lee, is because you would say if he was not removed, we're out of the deportation mm-hmm. language today, right? If he's not removed today, he's still in the United States, then you would invoke the express waiver authority that Congress has embedded in 1227. You would point to the pardon from the Illinois governor. You would say that he does not have, he can remain here even though he's been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, and the reason is because of the pardon that the Illinois governor has issued.
Actually, no, Your Honor. I would say that he is neither deportable or inadmissible, and none of this applies to him. Because again, 227 goes back to being applied to those that are deportable. My client was never deportable, has never been deportable. So he doesn't have to rely on that. And then once you take the conviction out of it for the issue of inadmissibility, he's not inadmissible. He just walks in the door.
So I guess I'm kind of
a bizarre situation.
Yes. So based upon what Judge Scudder was saying, so take the counterfactual. Assume that the government had not physically taken him to Poland, right? So he's here. So what avenue then would be available to him?
That would have been the sua sponte reopening by the Board of Immigration Appeals. We did, in fact, have to demonstrate that there were exceptional circumstances under these facts that would require the board to reopen and re-examine the case. And our argument is that those existed because we quite literally...
And what you would want re-examined is you would want the deportation order terminated.
There is no deportation order because it's a...
You'd want him to remain in the United States. And you'd want him to remain in the United States on the basis of the pardon, because the pardon wipes out...
His inadmissibility.
The prior crime of moral turpitude.
Correct.
That's what you'd be asking for.
Correct, Your Honor. It would be that... Once that pardon existed, he's no longer inadmissible. That it's honestly can be that simple, and you know.
And the board has the authority sua sponte to make that determination.
They have the determination to determine whether or not the facts have changed, and whether or not my client is fact. I mean that's what an immigration judge does every day. Again, Your Honors, I think quite a bit over my time, and I had reserved.
No, we appreciate it very much. We'll give you a minute on rebuttal, though.
Let's hear
from the counsel for the Attorney General.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, Tim Rims on behalf of the United States Attorney General. Just before I get into my own argument, what the panel is discussing with opposing counsel is removal that just happened. It had nothing to do with what he's actually challenging in this case. What he's challenging is the consequences of his re-entry in 2019 and what happened from there. This current removal is because he was found inadmissible or removed and executed that removal order. So what he wants to do is unwind that. So his removal has nothing to do. It doesn't add to what he's arguing in this case. What he's challenging is the 2019 inadmissibility finding. So.
By the way, what did you ever get figure out why it was that the government ended up removing him anyway, even though they made all these representations that they wouldn't?
I did. I'm concerned about that too when I got the case. So I spoke with ICE counsel, who they spoke with, and I also spoke with others in ICE about what happened in this timeline. And it was just, unfortunately, everything was happening last minute, and communications weren't received by the right people to halt his placement on the airplane in time. So this is November 27, 2020. It was the day after Thanksgiving. And it was going into the weekend. He filed for his emergency stay at 3:31 p.m. that day. The board granted at some point after that, and he's being staged for removal out of Dallas. And so he did send an email to the general inbox at Dallas ICE, and that wasn't received by the actual case officer until about 9:15 that night. He was already on the airplane. The airplane took off at 9:30 p.m. that night. And that deportation officer actually did not even read the email until the next morning. And so there was no way to halt what happened.
What about the representation, at least in the briefs I saw, about the government saying that he wasn't on the manifest?
I spoke with ICE counsel about this, and they don't recall that being something that happened. But what they did say, they discussed facilitation of return briefly with petitioner's counsel, and they never made any agreement to that, because why would they? They are on the impression that he was, he has his order and he was properly ordered removed. But they said if this court should, they wanted to wait to see what happened. They're going to wait to see what happens with this court and then whatever the remand happens. But then they might facilitate his return based on that, but there was no agreement to return him. It was just laying out the policy. Yes, if something happens or you require a remedy, we'll discuss facilitation of return.
Let me ask you this. Let's just assume for discussion purposes only, okay, that we deny the petition. What avenue of relief, if any, would he have available to him to pursue the facilitation of return?
Well, it'd have to be some kind of order ultimately granting his LPR status back. And I think that's why there really is ultimately no remedy. How can he get his LPR status back? He was properly found inadmissible for a crime involving moral turpitude, a CIMT. As the board explained, they properly found the pardon has no applicability to him because he's inadmissible. As courts have found, the plain language of the pardon waiver only applies to deportable aliens.
What about this in matter of H decision of the immigration board? How does that factor into this? It hadn't been mentioned yet today.
A matter of H, it was ultimately not relevant. As the board explained, matter of H has been abrogated by the pardon waiver. Matter of H is a very old decision from 1956.
It's still around.
It was interpreting a different provision, the old pardon waiver. And I also misdescribed that decision in my brief. I said that they extended it back then to an exclusion ground and a deportation ground, but they actually did not do that. They extended it to two different deportation grounds. So there never is a decision out there that's ever actually extended the pardon waiver to an exclusion ground, which is what today's modern day inadmissibility ground is.
Are you relying on what, 1227?
Yeah, so 1227 is deportation grounds, 1182 is inadmissibility grounds, which was formerly exclusion grounds. And so in matter of H, they don't actually extend the pardon waiver to exclusion grounds. They still keep it within the deportation statute grounds. There was just two different provisions. There was the pardon waiver, and then there was someone who was deportable by virtue of being excludable at the time of entry. So they extended it to that, but it still was two different deportation grounds. So they said that language could be extended to another deportation ground, but they've never actually extended it to an exclusion ground or an admissibility ground.
Historically, Congress has not amended the exclusion grounds, has it, when it has dealt with deportation?
Well, there's no more exclusion grounds. They amended it in 1996 to create inadmissibility grounds.
Yeah, I know the terminology situation, but it's the same government action. And they usually didn't specifically amend that ground when they amended the deportation ground.
The CIMT ground?
But if you were not deportable, you were not inadmissible.
You would never be subject to both at the same time, no. Because you're either be treated as inadmissible or treated as deportable based on your procedural standing. Mm-hmm. So you'd never be subject to both at the same time.
I just want to make sure that this is true, that it's legally irrelevant here. If that airplane had never taken off, we weren't in the holiday weekend, plane never leaves Dallas, and he's in the United States, that way, okay? Maybe maybe detained in the United States, but in the United States, could he then have invoked the waiver authority that resides in 1227?
No. It is legally irrelevant. So what the board's explaining is that before this all happened, he wanted reopening for sua sponte based on this pardon. And the board explained, well, we're not going to find this to be an exceptional circumstance to exercise our sua sponte authority because, first of all, the pardon doesn't mean anything to you. You are moving charges inadmissible. You'd have to be a deportable alien, non-citizen, to have the pardon waiver applicable to your case. So it doesn't mean anything to your case legally. We could find it to be an exceptional circumstance on its own, just the fact that the governor issued you a pardon. But as the board explains, we're not going to find that either.
So the logic doesn't work this way. The crime of moral turpitude renders him inadmissible. Is that part correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then does the inadmissibility render him deportable?
No. He gets removed because of his inadmissibility. So that's where the language can sometimes
be
confusing.
Go with removal then. Is he removable because of the inadmissibility?
Yes.
Okay. So if he had not been removed, he still can't invoke the 1227 authority. You're saying he's got to go back to the kind of step one. He's got to show that he is not inadmissible. Sorry for the double negative. He's got to show that he has status here.
You'd have to show that he was ordered under the deportation statute 1227 in order to have the pardon waiver applicable to him, because that is under 1227. And the pardon waiver specifically says it only applies to 1227. And many courts have interpreted that he was charged under a different statute because of his reentry. And that's ultimately what he's challenging. That's why I interpreted that as an equal protection argument in my brief, because he's saying it's not fair to treat me as inadmissibility. If I would never have left the United States, I would have been charged under 1227 as a deportable alien. But he never...
And you're saying that's not accurate? Or it is accurate?
That is accurate. By virtue of his visit to Poland and seeking reentry, he was charged under 1182 by virtue of the statute 1101A13, which treats someone, an LPR, who's coming back into the United States as inadmissible if they've been convicted of certain crimes. So he's correct.
So for admissibility purposes, a pardon does not extinguish a prior conviction for a crime of moral turpitude.
No, it does not. And many courts have upheld that. It just simply does not extend to that. Congress was plain. It's only for deportation grounds. And so if you view it as an equal protection argument then, because I realize that's the only argument they have, I think, is that it says it's unfair for me to get this pardon, however, just because I was... this mechanism made me inadmissible. And the government pointed out there's a really rational basis for that reason, because if petitioner would have reported his convictions in 2011 when that happened, he would have been placed in deportation proceedings as an aggravated felon. There's three different grounds I can think of. Fraud or deceit, he had a crime of fraud. There's fraud crimes in excess of $10,000. His was in excess of $100,000. Crimes of forgery. He was convicted of forgery. These all could have been different aggravated felony grounds.
So I think what you're saying is a practical matter. I'm just saying this colloquially. I'm not saying this legally. The mistake he made was leaving the country.
Mistake he made, yeah.
I mean, forget the crime of moral turpitude, right? He was convicted of a crime of moral turpitude. If he hadn't been convicted of that, we'd never even been having the discussion at all that way. But with that conviction in place, he then left the country. When he seeks reentry or readmission into the country, the flag goes up.
Yes.
At that point in time, and that's the problem for him.
That is the problem for him, because he flew under the radar this whole time, not reporting this conviction, because he would have been placed in deportation proceedings. And he waited until he had to come into contact with immigration authorities. Then immigration authorities discovered that conviction. So he tried, maybe not to firmly conceal it, but he certainly wasn't forthcoming about it until he was forced to do so. And that's why we say, when you're talking about equal protection, it's certainly fair for Congress to say, well, if it's up to that point where we're forced to pull it out of you, they want another opportunity to look at your suitability to be a resident of the United States. And that's why they have that mechanism in statute which treats them as inadmissible, because that subjects them to 212H, that discretionary relief.
And with regard to his being removed from the country and the circumstances we discussed earlier, if he hadn't been removed from the country, then what you're saying is what the law requires to do is deny this petition, and so he would be removed from the country now.
Yeah, nothing would change. Any other questions, Your Honors?
I don't think so. Thank you very much. We'll give you a full minute on rebuttal.
Okay, just a few things. First of all, I wanted to address, all due respect to government's counsel, I spoke to someone on November 27th. Many someones. It was one of the proudest moves of my career, stopping someone from being removed from the United States. So I would recommend maybe he discuss and investigate that a little bit further about what representations were made by ICE. Additionally, my client has never been deportable. If he had not left the United States, the United States government could not have issued him enough a notice to appear. He, under the statute, it's a single scheme that did not take place within 5 years of him becoming a lawful permanent resident. He was never deportable. Finally, we are not relying on the pardon waiver under 1182. What we are relying on is the fact that an inadmissible alien, if they have a pardon, is no longer inadmissible. And it's very clear in under the Code of Federal Regulations, under the Foreign Affairs Manual, and it's also what we will be relying upon when we do bring him back as the immediate relative of a lawful permanent resident with a U.S. citizen wife. But now we have to file a waiver for the removal that occurred because the government unlawfully removed him when he had his stay of deportation, which I would have sought a stay from this court had he still been here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, we appreciate it very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the petition under advisement.